Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast Special Edition. Yes, the first of 8 special episodes releasing over the next 8 weeks. I'm Joe Devine, and I'm now joined by the host of said special podcast. It's John McKenzie. Hi, John.
Hello.
What are you doing here, John?
I am spending 8 episodes talking to some very interesting people across the industry on a range of different topics, from tactical stuff mainly, but also touching on some geopolitical stuff. We've got a World Cup coming up as well, so we'll be talking about that. I'm just really excited to have some interesting conversations with some interesting people.
And who's the first of those interesting people?
So in today's episode, I will be talking to Jonathan Wilson, the author of Inverting the Pyramid.
Hot diggity dog. That is good.
And I'll be talking all about his book and looking back over a decade to see the impact that book has had and whether or not he's changed his ideas on things. And
can I shock you?
You can.
Even I've read that book.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's very influential, isn't it? Well, I can't wait to hear this episode. Yeah?
Me neither.
We'll start it now.
Yes.
Okay.
Hello and welcome to TIFO Talks, a podcast on the TIFO Football Podcast Network. I'm John McKenzie, and I'm joined today by the godfather of football tactics writing, Jonathan Wilson. Jonathan, thank you for coming on today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jonathan is obviously a football writer, the editor of the Blizzard magazine, and the author of books about Sunderland, England, Liverpool, Manchester United, Barcelona. And then we've got some socio-historical books, so Behind the Curtain, so that's all about Eastern European football. Angels with Dirty Faces, that's about the footballing history of Argentina. The Names Heard Long Ago, which is about the golden age of Hungarian football and how it shaped the modern game. The Outsider, History of the Goalkeeper. You've also written a novel and a couple of biographical works as well, so Brian Clough biography, and then a book which has just come out, we're going to talk about a little bit later, Two Brothers, The Life and Lives of Bobby and Jackie Charlton. But the book that we're going to focus on mainly today, Inverting the Pyramid, which I suppose is your seminal work, I suppose it's the thing that you're best known for. Looking forward to having a good chat about that today. That was released in 2008, and then there was a second edition which came out in 2014, but it's obviously well over 10 years since you first published Inverting the Pyramid. So maybe to start with, just a retrospective look on how do you feel about Inverting the Pyramid looking back after all that time?
I sort of now realise that people say, how long does it take to write? Well, it took 10 months, which is ridiculous, but there'd been sort of 10 years before that, 15, 20 years before that, when I'd been thinking about those themes, thinking about those topics. I think I was profoundly lucky to catch a wave of rising interest in tactics. And that book sort of, it's become this sort of source material that lots of my other books are tributaries from that of, oh, here's a detail that didn't quite make sense at the time. How can I go into more detail about it? How can I explain that more? It still brings in money every year. So it's a very good thing to have done. And yeah, there was a third edition as well, and Touchwood will be a fourth edition next year. So every 5 years is the plan. But still buy it now. Don't wait till next year, because we don't know for absolutely certain that's happening. I know that is the thing. It is sort of infinitely updatable and revisable. And it's the revisions as well. It's not just sticking the chapter on the end. It's when you realize, oh yeah, I didn't quite get that right. Or you suddenly realize, I mean, I think the second edition suddenly I had to go back and fill in loads of details on Spanish football in the 1920s, because to explain Barcelona, yes, the first book came out in 2008, so Guardiola hadn't even been appointed at Barcelona at that point. And Guardiola's probably the most important thing to happen in football tactics, well, since the early 70s, since Cruyff first came along. But to explain him, you have to create the context. You then have to go back and you explain what the circumstances of Spanish football were before him.
You mentioned the context there before inverting the pyramid. You obviously were thinking about football tactics at that point. We'll talk a little bit more about the sort of prompts that led you to write the book, but where were you at before inverting the pyramid in terms of tactics writing? Was it something you were consciously doing, or was it just something that was the way that you wrote about football at
the
time?
Well, I think I mentioned in the intro of inverting the pyramid, it was during year 2004 when I was working for the FT. And the FT, in their wisdom to save money, decided to have journalists share rooms, which is just a terrible, terrible idea. So there was some tension, shall we say, between me and the lad I was sharing with. He seems to have gone on to have an annoyingly great career, but never mind. And there was four FT journalists out there in Portugal, and we were having tapas one night in Lisbon and got into this massive row about whether tactics mattered or not. I was very much on the side of yes. The lad I was sharing room with was very much on the side of no. I think it's fair to say he's not a football specialist. And I sort of hadn't realized how strongly I felt about the importance of tactics. And the fact that you then realize that, you know, that Galliano line, I don't particularly like Galliano, but that line, tell me how you play and I'll tell you who you are. And I think there's a profundity to that. And you realize, well, yeah, football tactics are the most obvious manifestation of how culture has an impact on football. You know, to play in a certain way, there have to be certain stimuli to make you think in that way. And I think people can take that too far. I think a lot of the talk of national styles can be pretty blunt stereotypes and are not necessarily particularly useful. In certain cases, as in Argentina in the 1920s, it's utterly self-conscious, and therefore it is really important and interesting. If you're a coach, the way you look at football and the way you set about the winning of games, even if you think the winning of games is the most important thing or not, all of that is socially and culturally conditioned.
And do you feel as though that was a fairly representative position to be interested in tactics at those times, or were you in the minority at that point?
I think I was in the minority, but I think it was common. I mean, David Pleat had been doing his tactics column in The Guardian for a while, and he obviously had a certain popularity. I think you'd seen with Andy Gray on Sky going to greater depth than we'd gone into before. So, yeah, probably wasn't a minority among regular football writers, but I think they were very much sort of responding to football journalism, certainly pre the absolute takeover of the internet age, was a pretty conservative place. Yeah. But I mean, I absolutely did not initiate it. It was on its way. I just happened to be the one who got there at the right time.
Mm. And in terms of what actually prompted you to write the book, how did the book come about in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to say there was some great sort of plan, but I'd written the book on Eastern European football behind the curtain. And I was in an office with my editor and my agent, and we were talking about, you know, what should I do next. That behind the curtain had been well reviewed. It had done relatively well in terms of sales, not brilliantly, but you know, enough for them to be interested in doing another book. And we were knocking around some ideas, and I'd just done a big piece for 442 magazine on, I think it was, the 10 key tactical innovations. And some of that had come from behind the curtain, that people like Lobanovsky are clearly hugely important in the development of tactics, and Hungary as well, the withdrawn centre forward, and Shebesh and Bukovi and people like that. And so I said, yeah, maybe this is something that could be expanded into a book. And my editor had a few years earlier commissioned a writer from the Times called Peter Ball to write a history of tactics, and he died before he finished it. Mm. So he was already sold on the idea that this was something that was lacking. So as soon as I suggested that, he was like, yeah, definitely do that. So it was the second book I got a contract for, but then some of them were doing well under Roy Keane, and by chance the CEO of Orion is a Sunderland fan. And so he was very keen to do a book on Roy Keane and Sunderland. So that was sort of rushed out in between times. And then once I got going with the tactics book, it became a much bigger thing than I'd anticipated. I suddenly stopped thinking about the money and started saying, right, I've got to go to Kiev. I've got to go to Moscow. I've got to go to to Germany, I've got to go to Austria, I've got to go to São Paulo and Rio and Buenos Aires, and I've got to do proper digging. Mm. And what I sort of found was that every country was pretty comfortable in its own tactical development, but nobody was really putting it into a more global sphere. Nobody was sort of joining the dots. Mm. So what the book really becomes is the story of how ideas travel. And what's great about that is it then becomes about the individuals who've made them travel. So I think when you talk about tactics writing, you know, I'm not somebody who can look at a game and tell you instantly, you know, why it's gone. I might have an idea, but I'm not going to be able to go into granular detail straight away. And to maybe even after watching it back three or four times, I might not have the granular detail that a real specialist in that has. But what I was interested in was the people who carried those ideas. And you then realize that actually the whole thing is to do with the rise of fascism and Hungarians and Austrians getting out, which then becomes the name said long ago. Obviously now it's much more complex because the spread of information is much freer and much quicker, and everything's not siloed in the way it was 100 years ago.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that a little bit later, actually. But before we do that, obviously the whole book, and I think the longevity of the book, hangs on that metaphor that you landed on, inverting the pyramid. This notion that like you have these early front-loaded teams, and slowly through time, there's a realization that actually if you defend, it can benefit you. And we see that migration of players backwards. That's obviously a really nice metaphor to tell the story through.
And it was a really nice metaphor in 2008. Things have got a lot more complicated since.
Right.
And what's really annoying is me and my agent had an idea for a much better title, and we were in the pub, and by the next morning, neither of us could remember it. And I rang him the next morning and was like, what was the idea we had? Oh, yeah, it was really... Oh, I don't know what it was. So there is somewhere in the ether a better title, but I don't know. Nobody knows what it is.
There's an argument to be made, though, that like the better title would have been a less successful title.
Right? Well, possibly, yeah.
But I'm interested in how you arrived at that metaphor, because obviously that's the way that you're telling the story, and it becomes the framework in which you hang the history off. So was it something that arrived in an inspirational moment? Or
I think when you're doing, if you're doing a book like that, it could just be very episodic, which to an extent it is. It's not yet, naturally it is. But if you're trying to sort of create some overarching sort of thread running through, you're sort of thinking, well, we begin with 127 or 226 or 235 when people really start thinking about it for the first time. And by 2008, it looked like centre forwards were being refined out of existence, which was, you know, before Messi did it. You know, that first book, the first edition of it, really ends with Totti doing it for Spalletti's Roma, and with United doing it, with Ronaldo, Rooney, and Tevez sort of sharing that role. And what you now realise, or what I now realise, is that I totally underplayed the importance of Carlos Queiroz in that. And Queiroz is coming from this Portuguese school that, you know, has produced, you know, Queiroz to Vítor Fradi, to Mourinho, to Andy Villas-Boas, to Marco Silva. You know, that's all linked to the Manchester United. And so the fascinating thing that I didn't go into in that book, which I really wish I had done, is Mourinho turns up in England in 2004, wins the league twice. And how does Ferguson topple that? He brings in the originator of the Portuguese school. He fights Portugal with Portugal. Mm. And that's the thing I think at the time, none of us were really sort of conscious of. And I think probably now we would be more aware of that, because I think we're much more accepting the role of assistant managers in generating styles and methods.
So
the point was, we'd gone from 2-3-5 to 5-3-2 or 4-4-1-1 or 4-3-3 non. So it seemed a very obvious, this has gone from being very attack heavy to very defense heavy. Mm. And if you take 2-3-5 to 5-3-2, it's a very nice sort of inversion.
Mm. And I guess once you've got that metaphor, you can just sort of write the history. So once you'd got this sort of idea of, you know, the inversion of the pyramid, was that easy to just
write? Well, yeah. I mean, it's sort of a history sort of, it's pretty easy to trace up till 1990-ish. And I don't know whether it becomes harder to trace after that because the football gets more complex, or because we're still too close to really, you know, get the distance to sort of strip away the needless detail. But it, you know, you see pretty obviously that we go from 235 to WM to 4-2-4 to 4-3-3 to 4-4-2 to Catenaccio sort of hanging around in that same era, to total football, to pressing in the Liverpool way of doing it, or the English way of doing it in the late 70s. Lobanovsky, another, pressing really has the three avenues, the English, the Dutch, and the Soviet. And then I guess you get the Heysel-Bahn, which from an English point of view is sort of a dead end. And then you get, well, from early 80s onwards, the back three returning. Although the back three, the back three was around in, Jim Smith used it, for instance. I think Sunderland used it under Len Asher, so the 1985 League Cup final, which I hadn't realised. I interviewed David Corner, the bloke who made the mistake that let Norwich score 2 or 3 years ago. And I was like, what was the system? I don't know. How does this work? And then spoke to David Corner. He was like, it was a back three. But when Chelsea won the title under Conte in, when was that, 2015? 2017.
15 was Mourinho, yeah.
Yeah, and then Leicester 16. That was the first time anybody won the English league with a back three since Everton in 63, which is remarkable. So anyway, so the point being that story is pretty easy to trace. And you're looking at people know those individual stories, but you're looking at the transition. Yeah. Why did it change? Who were the people who made that change?
What was the research process like? Because obviously a lot of these tactical ideas aren't being explicitly written about necessarily, right?
Well, they're not. They weren't in England. They absolutely were in Brazil or Italy or Germany. Yeah, the sort of reluctance to discuss tactics that for a long time we had here doesn't really exist elsewhere. And then, there had been work done elsewhere. So, to an extent, my job was synthesis and filling in the gaps. Which I guess any history is synthesis and filling in the gaps, unless you have some radical new detail. The thing that I think was most significant in drawing it all out, and it was sort of the moment when I knew this sort of diagram that I'd drawn worked, was in Brazil. So Brazilian football, really up until late 30s, wasn't as dominant as it should have been in South America. They were very much the third power behind Argentina and Uruguay. And that begins to change. And this is pretty well attested in Brazilian histories with the arrival of Dori Kushner at Flamengo in 1936. Except they called him Dori Kushner. And then, so who was Dori Kushner? Oh, we don't know. He was a European. Right, but have you looked beyond that? And a couple of historians go, well, I've tried to find him, but he's just not in any records. He doesn't exist. And so there was a bloke called Roberto Assaf, who's sort of the absolute doyen of historians of Flamengo, had written to, I think, the five Central European FAs saying, do you know who this bloke is? And they all replied, nope. And then there was a radio journalist in Budapest, a mate of mine, said, are you sure it's Kushner, not Kushner? And the R and the E the other way around. And I don't know why. Well, he's Dori Kushner. No, he played for MTK, won 5 caps, and then he succeeded Jimmy Hogan at MTK in 1918 when Hogan returned to the UK. Yeah. And suddenly you say, okay, everything falls into place, that Hogan is not merely the father of Central European football. He's a huge influence on Kushner, who's the father of Brazilian football. So Hogan then is the grandfather of Brazilian football. And that was a fact nobody had put together before. So that's was a hugely important thing in getting that sort of family tree sort of flowing out. Mm. What I then realized was there had to be an equivalent figure in Argentina. And I found him, and I think in the first edition, I referred to him as Emerico Herschel, because that's what he was called in Argentina. And I didn't really go into too much detail because I thought, well, it's just replicating what I said about Kushner in Brazil. Mm. But I then sort of, when I did the Argentina book, I thought I should, and this is what I mean about sort of picking up details, I thought I should investigate who is Emerico Herschel, why did he go to Argentina? And you realise that he actually doesn't exist. His name in German would be Emerich Herschel, in Hungarian would be Imre Herschel, and he went by all three, but he never played football. He lied, he said he did, and I found his daughter still living in Buenos Aires. She said, he had all these stories about how he played in Prague and he played in Africa and he played in India and he played in Paris. He said, I just don't think he did. But you chase them all up and no, he didn't play for any of them. And it turned out he was just a bluffer, but also a genius.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
I'm interested in your sense when you're writing it, that you are writing the definitive history of football tactics. And I guess you had choices to make about which coaches to include. Were you aware of that when you're writing that a lot of this is just to do with, I guess, your preference for certain coaches?
Yes and no. I mean, I got a lot of criticism when it came out for not including more on Wenger, for instance.
Okay.
But you know, Wenger is clearly a great coach. I just don't think he was a particularly innovative coach. He was innovative in English terms, but I think what he was doing was pretty standard. So not all great coaches have to be innovators. I think the innovators stand out a lot. I mean, I got criticised in Germany for not really including many Germans.
Yeah.
But again, I don't think until the modern age, and certainly post-2008, Germany's had a huge impact on how tactics have gone. But Germany was, you know, even their sort of version of total football, I'm slightly cautious of even using that term about them, but it's a term that Glanville uses of them in the 70s. They didn't press. They were still using a libero and man marking. So they sort of worked out how to manipulate the ball and how to change positions, but they weren't pressing. So there weren't many Germans in there because German coaches weren't innovative until this wave of Rangnick and Klopp and Tuchel and Nagelsmann. Clearly there is some level of choice, but I think the actual innovators are pretty clear. I don't think they're that controversial.
Yeah, and I suppose the innovators often are the peripheral coaches as well, right? I even think of someone like Marcelo Bielsa, obviously an innovative coach, but in many respects has always been on the periphery of these sorts of discussions.
Yeah, I mean, he is at least pretty well known, and almost despite himself, has sort of projected himself into the mainstream discourse. I think that, you know, the interesting people from that point of view, people like Martin Francisco, who nobody in Brazil has really heard of, yet he appears to be the man who invented the back four. Mm. Certainly one of the earliest, you know, one of the pioneers of it, but he was doing it at a team called Novo Via, who never won anything, so nobody really paid them much attention. And I think that, yeah, that's certainly possible, that people were doing slightly unusual things at minor clubs, but they just never sort of invaded the general consciousness. And I think you've also got to be very careful that some coaches are just much better at projecting themselves. So I think Alf Ramsey, for instance, is massively undervalued as an innovator because he didn't talk about it.
Mm.
And one of the reasons, and he didn't talk about it for two reasons. A, he was very shy, and it just wouldn't have been natural to him to talk about himself. But also, he didn't want other people to know what he was doing. One of the extraordinary things that Ramsey does is he invents the 4-4-2, effectively. He uses it by mistake because of injury, not by mistake, but it's forced on him in a friendly away to Spain in December 1965. And he thinks, right, that works. And he doesn't use it again until the very last friendly England play before the World Cup, which is in Poland, against Poland in Chorzów, when he brings in Martin Peters and Alan Ball at the same time. So there's no winger. It's a 4-4-2. And it's in Chorzów, so nobody sees it. Nobody really pays any attention to it. And then he doesn't even use it in the group stage. He uses a winger in the group stage because he doesn't want the good teams to see what he's doing. And he finally unleashes it against Argentina.
Mm.
And then the remarkable sort of echo of that is Carlos Bilardo in 1986, who'd worked out the back three worked on this tour of Europe in 1984, which went staggeringly badly for a whole number of reasons. And so everybody sort of thought, oh, he's using a back three because he just doesn't have any fullbacks. And he's thinking, yeah, that works. Let's hide it away. And he brings it out in the quarterfinal against England.
Yeah.
And playing Maradona not really as a 10, but as a second striker. And suddenly Maradona has the platform and has his, well, two brilliant games plus the final.
Whenever I read Inverting the Pyramid, which I think is testament to how often I go back to it, but I'm always reminded of the quote by Michel Foucault, who talks about the present epoch is an epoch of space. And he wrote this, I think, in 1976. And I'm always made aware of that fact when I'm reading Inverting the Pyramid, because so much of that is about like thinking about space. How do we manipulate space? How do we control space? How do we exploit space? And you obviously get to the end of the book, and you know the question is, how far does that migration go? You talk about even 4-6-0 formations and stuff. And I just sort of wondered that, like, maybe we've reached the end of that epoch of space, and maybe we need a different metaphor now to talk about football. And wondered if you thought that you had any thoughts about what that metaphor might be like moving forwards.
I don't know. I still think fundamentally what you're trying to do with tactics is to get your extra man in space and get the ball to him. Mm. I think that's just fundamental. And equally, from a defensive point of view, you're trying to stop that. You're trying to shut that down. So I think at the highest level, football will always be the search for space. And you know, it's sort of David Winner who really, I think, brought that idea into the mainstream with Brilliant Orange. And yeah, he talks about the Netherlands as a nation as being very conscious of space and how they can generate more space with dikes and reclaiming land from the sea. But I read a thing this week that apparently they're now doing that in reverse in the Netherlands because this causes flooding. So there's a whole process of rewilding and sort of letting the sort of sandbanks return. And you sort of think, I wonder if that sort of, I don't think it does have any impact on football. But again, that's the danger of drawing metaphors from one sphere and sort of placing them over something else. There will never be a time when having your striker with the ball surrounded by players is a good thing. Mm. I just think the ways we generate space change. So you know, one of the ways that we do it now that we absolutely weren't doing in 2008 was a goalkeeper, in fact, he wasn't even allowed to do it, a goalkeeper taking a goal kick 5 yards. And you see that happening right down the pyramid now. And so that sort of panic of the goalkeeper's got the ball or the centre-back's got the ball, just hoof it, get it out. That's just not there. I mean, the goal Sunderland scored against Reading was a brilliant example. I mean, Reading didn't press particularly well, but you know, Sunderland have the confidence to do that. Last year, I went to see Red Star against Ashington, which is what, seventh tier? And they were passing the ball out from the back. And partly, see, that's for pitch technology. And that's one of those external factors I was talking about, that we now understand how you can... Actually, I don't understand. Some people understand how to put fibres within the pitch, which mean they don't break up, so they don't become quagmires, don't become mud baths. And once that happens, well, you don't have to have a velvety first touch to be able to take your first touch effectively for granted. And obviously, the ball being not this big, uneven leather thing with bits hanging off it, it changes weight during the game, changes mass during the game. And boots being much more delicate, much more receptive. And that, I think, is something Guardiola really benefited from in 2008, that quite apart from the law changes, which meant that smaller players weren't getting bullied out of games, weren't getting physically intimidated, that the playing area got bigger because of changes in the offside law. Also, just the equipment was better, so you could, and the pitch is better, so you can trust your first touch. And then the game becomes about moving the ball quickly to create the space. Whereas before, there probably was more of a safety first thing of, yeah, you don't want the ball rolling to your goalkeeper because it might bobble.
Yeah, I suppose space has become much more phasally based. Everyone thinks about what am I doing in this phase of play? What am I doing in that phase of play? These people talk about rest defense. So you're thinking, even when you're attacking, thinking about the structures that you have defensively to be able to actually control.
Yeah, well, if we lose the ball, what do we do? Yeah. What's our... Yeah, you attack in a way to ready yourself for a counterattack. Mm. So you're thinking that stage ahead. Yeah. But I also think... In the days when we talked about quite rigid 4-4-2s or 4-3-3s, your formations are almost irrelevant now. Yeah. And not quite a useful sort of, to give you a sort of a brief overview. But in the old days, I mean, 15, 20 years ago, you would get teams who were just 4-4-2 and they wouldn't move out. And just defensively, you want your structure. But now I think we're much more conscious that players need to negotiate their role within the structure, that the structure shouldn't be restrictive. It should be... Yeah. You know, a framework that you build upon. So Sacchi's idea that there are four aspects that should determine your position, your teammates, the opposition, the ball and the space. Mm. That seems to me something that should have been obvious for a long, long time, but it only really became obvious after Sacchi.
Mm. Yeah, I'm actually quite interested in the differences now between what we talk about as positional play, whatever people mean by that, but this sort of notion that you have a neutral space and you can talk about the central space and the half space and the wide space versus what we're seeing a little bit more with pressing teams like Red Bull system teams, where space is a lot more determined about the location of the ball. So you'll press to that location rather than thinking, oh, do we have the structures to attack with players spread around? So maybe different concepts of space is where the next metaphor goes.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. But I mean, I think there's always been, not always, but once pressing entered the mainstream, I sort of think that all football can roughly be divided into two testaments, pre-pressing and post-pressing. And that coming of systematization in the systematization, maybe rather than pressing, because obviously Catenaccio would fall into the systematization. So from the sort of mid-60s onwards, football is a structured team game rather than a game about individuals. And one of the things in the Charlton's book is how different Bobby and Jack saw that. And Bobby, and partly this is a psychological thing, that I think that in the late 50s, in that sort of 18 months between him making his debut and Munich, I mean, he referred to that as paradise. And it's him playing this individualistic, very attacking football with his mates, who were, you know, a year, 2 years, his age, or a couple of years older than him. And that must have been an incredibly intoxicating thing. And to be winning the league doing that, and then it's ended by Munich. And he spends his life trying to get back to that. But it's not just that he's lost his mates. It's that style of football disappears as well. Mm. And Jack, under Don Revie, I mean, Jack had been on coaching courses. It was him who persuaded Revie to go to a zonal system at the back. He saw that football was about structures and systems, and Bobby always wanted to be about the individual. And there's an amazing bit in Bobby's autobiography about, you know, Ramsey told him in the 66 World Cup final, you've got to mark Franz Beckenbauer. Beckenbauer was a midfielder in those days. And Bobby sort of said, well, can't Nobby Styles do it? And Ramsey was, no, because Beckenbauer sits very deep, so Nobby can't go that far forward. It's got to be you. And there's this sort of, Bobby talked about lying awake that night, sort of, should I do that? Is that the right thing to do? And yet he was still wanting to impose his individualistic model. But fortunately for him and for England, yeah, he had a sense of duty and a very sense of, you know, very clear sense of direct authority. I mean, he did after his national service, he said, oh, I think I probably would have done quite well in the army. Well, he probably would have done, because I think he liked having somebody telling him what to do. Mm. So Matt Busby and then Ramsey, and he followed Ramsey's orders and did mark Beckenbauer at the game. And yeah, he was 29 at the time, Beckenbauer was 20, so maybe he'd have dominated him anyway. But you see in 1970 the danger when he wasn't doing that. And that moment when he loses Beckenbauer in 70 and Beckenbauer strides forward and scores, albeit Benetti mistake. And that's the beginning of the end for Ramsey's England. Mm. That division between systematised and non-systematised football, I think, is profound. But once you then get into systematised football, obviously there are then different modes within that. And whether you press or whether you have a Catenaccio style defence with whether it's man marking with a modified system of zonal marking, and then that pressing, whether it's man oriented, ball oriented, or space oriented, mm-hmm. or some mixture, that's where we are now. And I think it's where data is going to be, probably already is, hugely important. The problem with talking about data in football is clubs don't tell you how they use it, because that's the arms race at the minute. Mm. But in terms of structuring your press, whichever mode of pressing it is, and using data to inform that and make it as sophisticated as possible, and then working out the best way of communicating that to players, that I think is the frontier we're at now.
Yeah, no, this sounds all fascinating. I could talk about it, but there's a lot. It's funny because it feels like we're going through the inverse again now with... We've got the elite coaches all systematizers, and then you've got Carlo Ancelotti's Real Madrid, who are... You know, the wonderful team of Galacticos, or however you want to call them, raising questions about how the systems work, right? And then the big question is, like, can Pep Guardiola win a Champions League with Man City?
But that's when it comes down to humans. I mean, nobody can believe Real Madrid were the best team in Europe last season. It's brilliant to watch them win, well, at least three ties they didn't deserve to win. In the final, they probably did deserve it. But... yeah, they were very, very lucky against PSG. They were very, very lucky against Chelsea, and they were very, very lucky against Manchester City. Yeah. And they were able to do it because they had a goalkeeper in brilliant form, a centre-forward in brilliant form, and a midfield that functions incredibly well, despite having a combined age of about 150. But there still is an element of systematisation there. You know, the way that Vinicius works off Karim Benzema, the way that Modric and Kroos and Casemiro set up that midfield. I mean, it's just automatic for them. They know what they're doing. I mean, but Ancelotti is just this very, very strange coach, full stop, that should be sort of a very Sacchi influence, doesn't appear to be. And the first man to win the league in each of the five major nations. Yeah, he's only ever won it once in each of the five major nations, as if he can't he can't generate the intensity to keep that going, to keep that consistency. And so you then sort of think, well, is he just the bloke who comes in after the innovator and sort of just calms everybody down and makes them feel good about themselves and builds on the foundations? But yeah, phenomenally successful. So you can't really knock it. He will not be appearing in any great detail in future pyramids because he's not an innovator.
Mm. I think one of the most interesting aspects of the book, and something you've touched on as well, is the localism of the book. This is about the transmission of ideas. And I suppose fundamental to that is the notion that, you know, you have a place where an idea hasn't reached and then it, you know, the idea can pervade that place, that country. That's not happening as much anymore. You touch on it in the epilogue to the second edition that we are in an age of globalization. Like, how do ideas transmit when, you know, someone can write a blog post about Fernando Diniz's Fluminense team and someone can read it 5 minutes later in Mongolia? It's hard to talk about the transmission of ideas in quite the same way as you've done it in
yeah, in, no, I mean, clearly that it gets pretty murky. It's sort of, yeah, all the plasticine's lumped into one. It's this horrible brown mess. The other thing that's changed, not just transmission of ideas is much quicker. It's that there's a real concentration of talent in, well, one league, to be honest, and maybe a handful of other clubs. And logically, that should mean, you know, if you believe all those theories about hubs of knowledge and the reason why, you know, the Silk Road sort of led to sort of great developments along its route, which I just do, then the Premier League should be where the vast majority of innovations happen because it's where we have the best players and the best coaches and they're constantly going head-to-head against each other. It's phenomenally exciting for us. I don't think it's particularly healthy for the world.
Do you think the innovation is happening outside of that at all? I mean, if it feels to me like in the Premier League, you sort of are hamstrung a little bit by just the amount of sheer talent that you have there. I mean, obviously, tactics is always going to help that, but it feels like there's a very elite brand of tactics. If you want to win playing with elite talent, then you play in a certain way, whereas there is
there's a truth to that. I just sort of, I'm just not sure it really matters if you, I don't know, you look at something like Bodø/Glimt. Mm. Obviously, it matters to Norway, it matters to Bodø/Glimt, but so it's almost like, you know, so what?
Until Kjetil Knutsen is brought to the Premier League, yeah. It doesn't exist, right? I guess.
Yeah, Pyramid is pretty self-consciously talking about the elite level.
Yeah.
It's just that the elite level used to be spread over 30 or 40 countries rather than one. Mm. You'd like to think that it might make a difference at the World Cup, but I suspect managers don't have enough time with teams. What I'd love is, and this really can only happen in North Korea, but I'd really love some North Korean genius to work out something totally new and away from any eyes looking at it, develop this sort of unseen brand of football and suddenly unleash it on the world at a World Cup. But I suspect that won't be happening.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
So this globalization and the shift to globalization, how does that impact the future of histories of football tactics, do you think?
Well, they get messier. It becomes very difficult. And things just don't, you know, things change much more quickly now. You can't just spin out the same style of football game after game after game. You have to make allowances for other teams. Other teams get used to how you play. I mean, I do wonder whether it sort of took 5 years, maybe 4 years, for people to work out how to play against Guardiola's Barcelona. That, yeah, if you say he starts 2008, they're phenomenally successful for 3 years. 2012, when Mourinho wins the league, I don't really think Mourinho sort of worked him out. He just sort of worn him down. And you think about the way they lost the semi-final of that Champions League to Chelsea It's a freakish result that set a pattern that we're still seeing today of Guardiola somehow losing big games inexplicably. Yeah. But I think the moment when sort of that era of Spanish hegemony comes to an end is those two semi-finals in 2013 when Dortmund beat Real Madrid and Bayern beat Barca. Yeah. And again, you can say, well, that's because Guardiola had gone and it was Tito Villanova. But that's when it feels like somebody's worked out a style that works against that Barcelona style.
Yeah. The end of football was over, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I think in the modern age, 4 or 5 years is actually a really long run. I'd be surprised if we saw a hegemonic style like that. And what it feels like now is we're just in the every way of playing at elite level now, maybe not Simeone, but apart from him, maybe not Ancelotti, is a variation on that Barcelona method. Mm. So even the German, the Klopp method, it's okay. From one hand, it's this team is really good at retaining possession. Therefore, we have to work out a way of being better at regaining possession. And so you get the Dortmund, Liverpool, incredibly ferocious, hard press to win the ball back. And then Guardiola adapts to that. And but Klopp's also gone towards the Guardiola model. And even pressing was the thing that sort of was most distinct about total football when it first emerged in the very late 60s, early 70s. So yes, Klopp's teams did it more aggressively. They did it with greater energy and they did it with less concern for what happened when they won the ball and protecting themselves against a counter. Mm. But they're accepting the terms of a debate, whereas Simeone, I think, stands in a totally different debate. Yeah. And Simeone, I think, looks increasingly isolated and old-fashioned.
Yeah. Julian Nagelsmann I find really fascinating in this respect, especially this season, because he's moved from like that tradition of Red Bull pressing, narrow attacking, direct attacking, counter-pressing, winning the ball back, destabilizing, and he develops this sort of more positional approach that you would expect from Pep Guardiola, but then gets rid of Robert Lewandowski and then goes back to a more sort of consciously Red Bull approach while he's at Bayern, which feels like the opposite way around as well. So
Nagelsmann, I sort of feel, is a bit of a victim of Germany and the nature of German football, that clearly phenomenally talented coach, but he keeps failing in Europe. Mm. And so his Hoffenheim, when they played Liverpool, okay, clearly they're underdogs. So that Champions League playoff, when was that, 5 years ago? Something like that?
Yeah.
And I'd sort of thought, oh, this could be a real test for Liverpool. But it wasn't. They just
blew them away.
Yeah. And then with Leipzig, every time it's sort of, you thought, oh, this is the Nagelsmann's real test. Mm. He fails it. But he's not really getting, okay, with Leipzig, you do get tested maybe in 2 or 3 games a season or against 2 or 3 opponents a season. Still a lot of teams a lot worse than Leipzig in the Bundesliga, and with Bayern it's even worse. Yeah. And that's a massive problem that modern football has, and particularly modern football outside the Premier League, that you have to have two totally different models of how to play. Yeah. It's hurt PSG, it's hurt Juve, and in fact it continues to hurt Juve, because there's attempts to put that right that have caused the collapse within Italy.
I'd really like to see maybe a tactical history talked about in terms of when winning the league was the most important thing to when winning competitions was the most important thing, because that definitely has an impact in your tactical style, right?
Competitions as in cup competitions?
Cup competitions, sorry.
No, definitely. Well, in fact, you see that. If you look back, there was, what's it called? It was a local paper in Sheffield, the Sheffield Telegraph and Star, I think. It, for some reason, it led the world in tactical coverage in the first decades of the 20th century. I've got no idea why, but I salute their editor for making that decision. And then they have a very clear idea that there's a distinction between a league team and a cup team. So I think Barnsley were famous as a cup team because they were sort of hard-fighting grafters rather than people who you back to score goals over a consistent period of time, which sort of slightly feels like the opposite of what you'd expect. You'd think that the sort of grafters would be the ones who would be able to keep it going through a league season, whereas your sort of flimsy Tottenham of the 1980s would be the cup team. But Sheffield Telegraph and Star, if that is indeed what it's called, had it the other way around. So, but yeah, I think you're right that I think that's also changed with things like squad sizes. In doing the Charlton's book, you realise Leeds were the best team in the country for years. We never won anything because they were too good. Yeah, they didn't have the squad to keep up with how many competitions they were battling in. Mm. And yeah, if a season had finished in the beginning of April every year, they'd have won everything. And you have a famous game against Derby in, I think it was Easter Monday, 1970. It's just before they lose to Celtic in the European Cup semi-final. Yeah. So yeah, and so supposedly it's one of the reasons why Clough had his massive falling out with Revie, was Revie picked the second string side for this league game. Derby won 4-1 because he had the cup final coming up and these two legs of a European Cup semi against Celtic. And they got fined for it. But now it would be a completely... Maybe we'd fine a team for resting players before a cup final now.
I've got a question here just about the response to inverting the pyramid. So inverting the pyramid is so exhaustive a history in many respects is that it almost feels unassailable. And what I mean
hope
by
so.
That, yeah. Well, what I mean by that is that, you know, in order to disagree with anything in it, you have to be so erudite and well-read in both history and football history that there's almost no one who can actually, outside of academia, I suppose, be able to sort of raise many questions about it. So I wondered if you felt, because your background is in academia, whether or not you felt as though you didn't get as much pushback as you wanted when the books came out.
I don't want pushback. I just want people telling me I'm brilliant. I have actually had quite a lot of people. It's not really pushback. It's more sort of saying, oh, have you considered this?
Yeah,
or
sure.
So lots of people from all kinds of backgrounds and all different countries have sort of suggested, yeah, maybe this bloke's actually quite important, or maybe you've overstated this, or actually that's not quite how it played out. And so that's one of the useful things about being able to keep on revising it is it's not that it was wrong before, but you can be more precise. It's a history, it's not a catalogue, so you can't list everybody. You do get people who you sort of have trod in their particular area and they get very angry about that, and they, you know, accuse you of having misrepresented something, and then you do some reading on it, actually I'm okay or whatever, it's fine. But you know, I wouldn't pretend that it's absolutely 100% accurate in all regards. No book ever is. It can't be. And if people find mistakes or things that they think could be slightly tweaked or amended, by all means get in touch and I can have a look at it and see whether it does need a bit of a polish.
You don't anticipate anyone rewriting the whole history with a different metaphor? And
no. Well, good luck to them.
Yeah.
Don't, I'll come and kill you.
One more question just about just tactics writing in general, because obviously inverting the pyramid has become a catalytic moment for tactical writing about football. And obviously 2008 is a long time ago. The tactics writing sphere has burgeoned, should we say, since then. I just wondered what your thoughts are on the way that it's gone.
None of it can be bad, right? You know, people thinking about it, people talking about it.
I've seen some tactics writing that I consider bad.
Well, okay. But it's good that people are trying to engage. I wouldn't want to discourage anybody from doing that. And the internet is a very complex thing with many bad aspects. People writing blogs about tactics are not one of the worst aspects of it. A lot of it is nonsense. That's also true. And I worried about this myself, that, yeah, I'm not a footballer. I'm not a football coach. I've never played at any level.
What was that time in the Cambridge University leagues, though, that you scored that? Oxford, sorry. Yeah. Dear me, I've committed yeah. a heinous sin.
Yeah, look, if you want to talk about my curler against Christchurch in 1997, then I'm entirely... Well, okay, it was a corner, ball was cleared. Comes to Neil Shepherd, our captain, on the halfway line. I've come out with a defensive line. I'm on the left. He's played it through, little step over, drag it back to the defender's legs, corner of the box, bend it in. Beautiful, 11-0.
You described the goalkeeper as having a moment that reminded you of another goalkeeper.
It was very Gary Bailey against Ronnie Whelan in 1983. Yeah. And I respect him for that. He could have just stood and watched it and made it look rubbish, but he didn't. He did the full arched back, desperate. And they were already 10-0 down at the time, so he'd have had every right just to watch it go past him. But And I sort of thought, you know, is this the kind of thing that people in football are going to think is just absurd? Mm. And so you try and counter that by talking to as many people as possible and reading as many well-informed people as possible. And, you know, I interviewed, I don't know how many people, but you know, loads and loads and loads of people all over the world. And people like Graham Taylor were incredibly generous with their time. And every now and again, you see a coach mentions it and you sort of think, oh, thank God for that. I mean, I think I possibly have to take some blame for Craig Levein playing that 4-6 North for Scotland against the Czech Republic. He did seem to be talking very much in terms I recognised when he was describing what he was doing. And there was a moment, it was a Europa League final, I can't remember which one, but I found myself waiting by a luggage carousel at Luton or Stansted, one of the lesser airports. And it was late at night, there was nobody about. And suddenly David Pleat emerges on my right shoulder. Are you the one who wrote that book? Oh, God. Yeah, probably. What you said about Everton pioneering five midfield? What about my Tottenham? Go on, David, tell me about your Tottenham. And he talks me through it. But his point wasn't that I was wrong. It was just that I should have talked about him as well. Fair enough. So, you know, I now put in a sentence about his Tottenham. So I haven't found any football person who thinks it's rubbish. That's hopefully a good sign.
Yeah, a lot of it's problem solving, isn't it? And I think, you know, if you're a coach or if you're working as an analyst, then any attempt to try and solve the same problem, even if it is as oblique as someone blogging on the internet, I think is well respected. And there's a lot of, I mean, René Maric is the...
But there's also a difference between writing about tactics right now and in this moment and going back and asking a coach, what did you do in that game? Right. Or, you know, one of the things that was incredible treasure trove was finding Gustav Šebeš's notebooks. And the great thing is Šebeš was not a tactician, really. He was... So, you know, this is the coach of Hungary in the early 50s who leads them to the two huge victories over England in 53 and 54, leads them to the 54 World Cup, wins the Olympics with them in 52. And he really was he'd been a very good centre-half 10, 12 years earlier. So it wasn't that he was an idiot. It wasn't that he didn't know anything. But his skill was managing people and managing the communist committees. And he was constantly in dialogue with people like Martin Bukovy, who I think is the great tactician of the 20th century. And you know, Gyula Mandic, he had as an assistant for a long time because he knew that the tactics weren't really what he did. So his notebooks are fascinating because it's him explaining to himself what he's doing.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, you get people... One of the criticisms that I got was people say, oh, actually Hungary, when they beat England 6-3 at Wembley in 53, were playing a 4-2-4. And this, you know, Ron Greenwood said that and Terry Venables said that. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I haven't been able to find evidence of them saying that or precisely what they said. But you look at Čebeš's notebooks, it's not a 4-2-4. It's a stepping stone towards that. Mm. And I suspect that's probably what Greenwood or Venables said if they were, you know, whatever they said about that game. But it was clearly a three, Zakariash as a deep-lying centre midfielder who occasionally would drop in as a second centre-back. And Hidakuti is a centre-forward, but he's dropping deep. But he's never getting alongside Bostic. So it's a 3-2-1-4, if you want to put numbers on it, which clearly is close to a 4-2-4, but it's not what Brazil understood by the 4-2-4 four or five years later.
Yeah, I mean, my videos all the time have people in the comments being like, oh, you said this is a back three, but it looked like a back four to me. I think it's happened through all time, hasn't it?
People
disagreeing on what a formation is because it's very flexible.
Well, you saw that. I mean, the Graham Potter formation, Chelsea against Salzburg.
That was the very...
Oh, right, okay,
game where a lot of people are like, well, it's a back four.
Yeah, was Sterling a wing-back or was he a Tonante?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people saying he's a winger with
Tonante.
I was like, well, that's what I call a wing-back, right? A wing-back is a winger with defensive responsibilities. But,
I mean, there's no right, there's no wrong in that. Sure. The wrong thing is to be prescriptive about it.
Yeah. You've mentioned this book a number of times through the conversation that Two Brothers, The Life and Lives of Bobby and Jackie Charlton.
Yeah, always be selling.
Yeah.
Perfect Christmas present.
Sounds like there's a lot of tactical stuff in there, though.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think they do represent, and slightly oddly, I think they're the eldest of four brothers. So, but let's count, it's the thing just as a pair. And the elder one is the revolutionary and the younger one is the conservative. Mm. But they do represent those two strands, not just in football tactics, but just in life. Bobby was, in terms of personality, was very quiet, very reserved, very introverted. In terms of politics, I think he was a Daily Mail reading, loyalist, small C conservative. Whereas Jack, in as far as he expressed political, I mean, Bobby never really expressed political opinions. It's sort of other people said he was a Daily Mail reading loyalist, but it fits with what we know of him. And very keen on doing his duty and turning up and, God knows how many memorial services he had to go through. And Jack spoke in favour of a miners' strike, I think was instinctively on the side of the worker, whether that constituted any sort of really thought through socialist thesis, I doubt. But But he did think about it. I mean, there's a documentary he did, I don't know, early 90s sometime, when he sort of says, he goes back to Ashington, and Ashington was still not in a great shape, but was in a pretty bad way in the immediate aftermath of a miners' strike. And he says, oh yeah, I was on the side of the strikers, and I thought it was a terrible thing when the pits closed. He said, but you talk to many of the lads now, and they say it's the best thing that could have happened for them. You sort of think, well, you don't hear that perspective very often. Mm. I don't think it's fully true, but it's also not untrue that, you know, it's not like Jack's father's life, working 5.5 days a week underground, incredibly dangerous, uncomfortable, inhospitable conditions for not much money, was some kind of glorious age. It was just an age when Ashington was a bit more prosperous than it is now.
Mm. Yeah. And how can
the individuals weren't, the town was. And they had, you know, the incredible welfare clubs, and there was a real support structure there, which sport was absolutely the centre of, which I think is one of the reasons Ashington is this bizarre, produced three footballers of a year between 1961 and 1966, three different footballers of a year. The same street produced three different footballers of a year, both the Charltons and Jimmy Adamson, and has also produced two of England's greatest ever fast bowlers, one of whom won a World Cup.
And I presume you watched Sherwood on the BBC.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, I found that, as someone who obviously grew up after a lot of this stuff.
But in Nottinghamshire.
But in terms of just the way that sort of period and that sort of way of life shaped communities, I think is really interesting as well. And presumably that kind of comes through in the book as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I grew up in Sunderland, so the nearest pit to me had closed in the 60s. But, you know, you were aware of it and you were aware of its legacy. And certainly the shipyards were the things that I was sort of, as a kid growing up, I was aware of them disappearing. Mm. But yeah, I mean, I remember the miners' strike. I was a child. I was, 7, 8 during the strike. But I remember chants of football matches. And I remember this sort of instinctive hostility people had to the police. Mm. And so not really understanding why. And then sort of coming to understand that, well, if you're in opposition on the picket line, you're in opposition on the terrace as well.
So the story is told, is that opposition between the personalities of Jackie and Bobby, is that fundamental to the way that the story is told?
Yeah. I made an early decision, I mean, partly because Gabriel Clark's brilliant, brilliant film about Jack has sort of, I don't think there's anything else to be said about his dementia and about the family. And also Bobby now has dementia. The last thing, I went through dementia with both my parents. The last thing I wanted to do was to get in the way or ask awkward questions. And I found this slightly with the Clough book. Once you start talking to members of the family, you're compromised. It changes the type of book you can write. You sort of feel you have to prioritize the family's memories. And I don't feel comfortable going into private spaces. I think some people do it extremely well and some people do it with incredible sensitivity. Yeah. I personally would not be able to do that. And so I was much more interested in the public personae. And so you had Liam McKinstry's book on the two of them came out 22 years ago, something like that. And it's very different to that book because that's very much about them as individuals, as people. Mm-hmm. This is a book really about putting them in the socioeconomic picture and talking about how they're representative of strands of English culture in the Irish culture in the second half of the 20th century. Mm.
So the book's called Two Brothers, The Life and Lives of Bobby and Jackie Charlton. That's out now?
Yeah, yeah.
What's the best way of people getting hold of it?
Bookshops, Guardian website, Amazon, I mean, bookshop.org. Mm. I mean, don't go to Amazon. but if you can't get anywhere, go to Amazon.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the usual caveats apply. Buy in a sensitive way that gets me the most money possible and supports local booksellers.
Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on today.
Cheers, thank you.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic.
See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.